Let's take some of your calls if you want to join in with the conversation with our guest, David Orrell. But also, I'd like you to make your predictions. I know we do this around the first of the year all the time. This will be our springtime predictions for the future. Back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. David, the Gaia Theory, you write about it in your book, of course. Let's talk about that. I have always believed that this planet is alive as well, or nothing could live on it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's an extremely old idea. It goes back to the ancient Greeks. According to the legend, the prophecies at Delphi were initially read out by Gaia before the oracle was taken over by Apollo. So he did a kind of a hostile takeover of the oracle, if you like, and for the past couple of thousand years, you know, I think we've been sort of following the pollen system, and maybe the Gaian approach to forecasting is going to come back. Scientists, including Leonardo da Vinci, compared the Earth to a human being. The latest art version of scientific version of Gaia theory was founded in the 1960s by the British scientist James Lovelock, and it was really based on the empirical observation that the Earth system has self-regulatory properties. And by that I mean that the ecosystem has feedback loops that regulate the temperature to keep conditions suitable for life. So you can think of that as just as we have in our house, we have, you know, air conditioning and heating systems to keep the temperature not exactly stable but in a comfortable zone. So the planet itself has similar kind of feedback systems which keep the temperature at a reasonable rate. They also keep the salinity of the oceans, the degree of salt, within quite narrow bounds, just as they are in our own bodies. And so, you know, when you think about it, I mean, you know, the planet is we're kind of, you know, isolated in space, and yet the temperature is perfect for living beings. It never gets so hot that the oceans just sort of boil off. It never gets so cold that everything gets completely frozen and, you know, everything dies. It's all being kind of kept within this relatively narrow range. I mean, we get ice ages and so on, but it's still enough to support life. And that's the essence of Lovelock's Gaia theory.
Do you think the planet cleans out societies over and over again in order to heal itself, cleanse itself?
I think if you kind of go back right, I mean, before thinking about societies, if you go back to, you know, the different life forms which have lived on the Earth, I mean, there was a phase when it was taken over by microorganisms. So this is, you know, this is like a very early stages of the Earth development, just early stages of life. But it was taken over by microorganisms, which basically produced an enormous amount of oxygen and kind of completely poisoned the atmosphere. And so the Gaian system had to evolve, you know, in order to limit the population of those guys, to sort of get the oxygen content down. Because if you have too much oxygen content in the air, you know, is basically going to be explosive. So what I'm saying is that the climate has been influenced by life forms for millennia. Now, whether or not, certainly particular societies have been affected by changes in the climate. And, you know, for example, if you have extended drought or something like that, is enough to, there have been a number of civilizations which have fallen because of drought or because of other changes in the climate. I guess the thing which we're coming up to now is might be unique in the sense that our society, our civilization has grown to the point where we are actually affecting the Earth's systems, these regulatory systems.
Or speeding things up, maybe.
By heating things up and sort of in different ways. I mean, if you kind of think about it, the reason that the Earth works as an organism is because it has all of these life forms. It has these jungles. It has trees. It has life forms which are sort of constantly regenerating the atmosphere. Now, if you imagine that if you covered the entire world in concrete, okay, you know, it obviously wouldn't work. You know, all the heat would just kind of get radiated off into space and, you know, our atmosphere would disappear, right? So we're kind of at, obviously we're nowhere near that point, but we're at a point where we're We've taken over a lot of the land for agriculture. Our sort of cities and so on are growing to such a scale that they are fundamentally changing the way that the oceans and the forests and the atmosphere work as a kind of as a unit. I think a better way to look at it in a way is as a health. You know, like if you think of the Earth as an ecosystem, we are starting to perturb it to a point where we are affecting its health, probably in a not a very good way.
Okay, let's take some calls for you, David, or also people who are going to make some predictions. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Mike, you're on the air calling out of Ithaca, New York. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, David. Hi, everyone else. I'd like to chime in to say something about sort of perspective on all this.
Sure.
That is that what I think is that in terms of our ability to predict things, we are both very potent and very impotent at the same time. And that's the great beauty of it. And I just want to give one example, but I think this applies as a paradigm for all of our attempts to predict things. And that is, let's say you made a model of a children's playground on a room with a very smooth floor, and you had a slide, and you had a golf tee at the bottom of the slide, and you take a model of a bowling ball, but on this miniature golf slide, it's just a marble, and you roll it down this slide, and you have another marble of a different size on the golf tee. And when the ball rolls off the slide, the two collide. And we can't predict what direction that ball from the slide is going to go. It's like a random direction. But what we can predict is the two balls will go off in directions that are perpendicular to each other. And if we have a piece of carbon paper on the floor, so we have two marks left where the balls hit the floor, and we do this experiment over and over again, and then we take the carbon paper away, all the marks will leave two concentric rings around the tee, and the ratio of their radii will be equal to the ratio of the masses of the two ball, with the lighter ball having the longer radius. So if the lighter ball is one-third the way to the heavier one, it'll have a three times longer radius. So we can predict which circle balls are going to fall on, and that they'll fall on that circle, and that they'll move away from the tee in directions perpendicular to each other, but we absolutely can't predict what direction they'll go, except they'll be in two perpendicular directions. Anyway, I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer.
Oh, well, before you hang up, though, Mike, how does that relate to living every day? Tell me.
Well, to living every day? Well, we can make certain predictions, let's say, about animals or even people. Like, let's say, a gene that makes you decide to raise your nieces and nephews instead of your children would be selected for if the price of raising a niece or nephew is less than half of raising that of your own offspring. But you can't predict whether a particular person's going to do it, not yet anyway, but you could predict whether the gene's going to go up or going to go down. You might even be able to predict where the gene is on a chromosome map from looking at the rates different gene frequencies change.
All right, David, can you understand this? Can you help us with this?
Yeah, I certainly agree with the first part, which is that if you have a physical system, you can make those kinds of you might not be able to, as you say, sort of make the exact prediction, but you can make a statistical prediction about what will happen sort of on average. But I'd say that complex living systems are actually different. So that's I don't think it's possible to take the kind of mechanical analogy and apply it to the living system without a great deal of caveats, because the difference is that complex systems, they change and they adapt and they learn, so which is not the same as balls kind of rolling down slides. So if you have a person and you expose them to a particular stimulus, or you know, and you do it sort of several times, that person is going to adapt to the stimulus. That happens. I mean, that's one reason the economy is so hard to predict, you know, is that there is no kind of scientific cause and effect relation in the economy. That's why it's so.
Well, I can predict it. It's going down the tubes.
Yeah, that's true. It is now. You can say which direction it's going in, but you know, if you take this this credit crunch, for example, it wasn't predicted. I mean, there were probably some people who did predict it, but sort of the great mass of, you know, financial predictors, who, by the way, are the most, you know, highly paid predictors in the world, did not see it coming. It took them all by surprise, right? I mean, you know, that's why a lot of these sort of hedge funds are collapsing at the moment.
Sure. Well, you know, it's greed, too. I think They knew eventually it could happen. I think they were too greedy, David. And, you know, we've had some guests on this program years ago who predicted this housing bubble crunch and everything else. I think greed got to these people.
Yes, that's true. And also, you know, there's a sort of insane, the way that they're paid is kind of insane, because basically if they make a lot of money when their bets are right, and they don't really lose that much when their bets are wrong. I mean, you know, some of these here in London or in New York, if a top trader might get $50 million bonus, you know, in 1 year, which is like insane, right? And the next year, if their bets go wrong, then they don't lose anything. They just don't get a bonus.
Or one that big.
Well, yeah, that's right. So they're under an incentive to make sort of crazy bets, you know, for several years, right, and get rich. And then, you know, if everything kind of collapses after that, then, well, okay, you know, they just sort of go away. I think to go back to the thing about the living systems, like, for example, with the gene, let's say that you find a gene that has some effect. The problem is that in very rare diseases, one gene will have, you know, sort of a dominant effect, right? But in most things, let's say, you know, heart problems, cancer development, sort of chronic, or, you know, the conditions which affect most people, it's never one gene. It's always sort of a cluster of genes interacting with each other, interacting with the environment, interacting with diet, exercise, so on and so forth. And unpicking that statistically is very, very hard. You know, I'm not saying that you can't get useful information out of it, but I'm saying that it's just not in the same class as the kind of mechanical type problem. So prediction works brilliantly in physics and engineering, you know, and it's just when you get into these other areas that it really starts to get more difficult.
David, a few years ago, I used to own a couple of racehorses, harness racehorses, you know, where the driver sits behind the horse in a sulky.
Right.
And I developed a piece of computer software. I had a software company put it together for me. But I basically created a predictor of what might win the race based on a number of factors, which then they interviewed me and weighed these various factors. And they included the fastest time on the last quarter. How close the horse was to the rail coming off the gate, you know, and the gate and harness horses, a car moves and the horses are behind this gate that's moving with them, and then the car speeds away. So there were a number of different factors that they had to weigh, what were the most relevant. And we started playing with the program over 6 months or so, and got to a point where I got to tell you, it was pretty accurate in terms of predicting a winner. Has the computer world increased predictions for science?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely. Because computers now can look for patterns. There's so much data becoming available. I mean, data about, let's say, for stores, for example, data about what consumers are spending money on, where they're traveling to, and so on and so forth. So there's an enormous amount of data, and computers are quite good at picking out patterns in that data that people might not have spotted. But what's sort of interesting, actually, is what you just mentioned is a relatively simple, by the sounds of it, prediction method. And sometimes those things can actually work pretty well, because they, there was a story recently about a guy who wrote a program that was going to predict the quality of wines for a particular vintage, just depending on kind of the weather conditions, like whether the, you know, the previous year's weather was good, you know, go back 2 or 3 years, whether it was good, whether it rained a lot, it didn't rain, you know, so on and so forth. And he kind of sort of adjusted this model so that it gave the right results for the past data, and then ran it, you know, for the next data. And he showed his prediction to a bunch of wine experts, and they all said, oh, this is, you know, total rubbish and it won't work. And, you know, and they made their own predictions. And then when they did the test, his simple model actually outperformed the experts. And they are finding that sometimes there are these patterns in data. And they're kind of, I would compare them a little bit to, you know, weather forecasting in the early days, okay? Because weather forecasting in the early days, what they were doing is they were saying, well, look, there's a storm over there. The wind is blowing this way. So we're probably going to get a storm over here quite soon. In order to do that, I mean, they had to have all these new observational systems in place, right? You know, so there, it was kind of a big step forward from what they'd had before. But it's sort of difficult to go beyond that. So I think, for example, with your program, you're probably getting some basic insights into the performance of your racehorses. To actually go beyond that and have a truly predictive model, things would get much more tricky.
Mathematics has a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, first-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Gentlemen,
hello.
How are you doing today?
Good, good. Thank you.
My first question would be, is if someone could predict something, that's like a guess, but if someone can actually see something and then it happens, would that also be a prediction, or would that be actually seeing the future?
Like a sort of a visionary type thing?
Okay. Now, I've only told my wife this, but like there's been many times I would see something and then momentarily later it would happen. Or like today, for instance, I took something from my father today and then I called him up to let him know. And he's like, oh, you're reading my mind. He goes, I've been trying to figure out what was going on. Or the phone would ring. My wife would pick it up. She'd make her two talk, hang up. I come downstairs and like, what'd your sister want? And she'd be like, well, how'd you know my sister called? And it's not like I try to do it. It just comes. And then when you try and do it, it's like making a guess, and 9 out of 10 times I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm asking?
I think so. I think there's two theories. I mean, well, one is that we tend to remember things when they work out positively, right? So that if you kind of get a hunch that let's say the phone rings and you think, oh, that's going to be so and so, and then it is, then you tend to remember that. Where mm-hmm. The times when you kind of pick it up and think, oh, I'm going to be so and so, then it's not. You know, it's like salesman or whatever, then you don't remember those. So over time, you might think that, you know, you're kind of getting better at it. I mean, the other theory is that, you do actually have some kind of intuition or a hunch or a connection with the other person. You know, and that's always sort of this, they're always trying to test that, right? You know, trying to test extrasensory perception and so on. And I guess it's just so hard to do, you know, because it sounds like it's one of those things where if you, just sort of like you say, I mean, you can imagine that, I imagine that if a bunch of scientists put you into a room or something like that and, you know, isolated you and asked you what color card they were holding or something, your mind would probably, well, my mind would go totally blank.
Wouldn't it be great one day, David, if they truly can come up with a computer model that truly predicts the future? With great accuracy,
I think it would be great, but I think it's not actually going to happen, and the reason is that it goes back to, you know, this sort of self-regulatory thing that we were talking about for the Earth system. This applies to all complex systems, and that self-regulation, when you think about it in mechanical terms, it sort of turns out that the systems are very, very unstable.
You may be right. We'll be back with more phone calls when we come right back. And your questions with our guest David Orwell. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with you. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with David Orwell. David, do you make predictions yourself?
I do. Well, at the book, I in the last section, I came across so many predictions while I was researching the book, and I wasn't really sure what to do with them. So in the last chapter, I list a large number of them, and most of them are actually pretty disastrous. You know, it's all things about melting ice caps and burning rainforests and killer heat waves and this kind of thing. But, of course, the problem is that these are mostly based on models which can't predict, you know, the next hurricane or the recession. So For my own predictions, I actually kind of boiled it down to two different scenarios. One, the sort of negative, pessimistic sounding one, which is that, you know, we're all going to all of these problems like overpopulation, resource shortages, income inequality, and global warming are all going to spiral into a kind of catastrophic crash. But I think the other one is actually more likely, which is that we're going to experience a revolution that leads us to a sustainable society and addresses all of these problems, you know. And I think actually that this process is already underway at the moment.
Well, and when you say revolution, that could be a moment of enlightenment, or it could be wars between all of us.
Yeah, I guess I see it as a kind of a shift in consciousness where we fundamentally change the way that we think about the world, think about our relationship, first of all, to the rest of the planet, but also to the each other. So it has effects on the economy. I have a book coming out in May called The Other Side of the Coin, which sort of follows on from The Future of Everything. And what it does is it looks at how science has influenced our economic thought, you know, over the years, and how all of these new sciences, such as complexity, chaos theory, network theory, and so on, together with social movements like environmentalism and feminism, are starting to show the way now towards how we can reconfigure the economy and get back into balance both with the planet and with each other.
People who had the ability to look into the future, like Edgar Cayce, the late American prophet, all predicted also disastrous outcomes for landmass and those kinds of areas on North America. It kind of backs up what you saw in some of the science predictions.
Yeah. Well, there are definitely some fairly, you know, grim predictions out there, right? You know, I guess. Some of the more concerning ones are that, you know, we're gonna pass a kind of a tipping point. So if you think that you know, global warming, up until now it's been this sort of slow incremental thing, right, where the temperature's just been inching up a little bit. There are lots of theories which says that if you get above a certain point, then the process will accelerate quite rapidly. I mean, just for example, like in I'm from Canada, the north of Canada, they've got tons of tundra, you know, enormous areas of this, which contains a lot of trapped carbon dioxide under the soil, and it's all sort of trapped under the ground because the ground is frozen. But you can imagine that if the temperature gets above a certain point, then that ground will melt, and the carbon dioxide will be emitted from the ground, and that will feed the global warming, and, you know, and so on. And so you get this kind of exponential increase in the temperature. So there are a number of theories, along that kind of theme.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, this is Diego, Newport News, Virginia.
Hi, Diego.
Hi, George. It's been a long time since I've been trying to get you, but anyway, I'm so glad I got through tonight. And hi, Dave. How you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm intrigued by your concepts about predicting. I'm wondering if I can make a few predictions over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is after the 21st of October of this year, the planet X we should be able to see it in the sky.
Okay, and in your predictions, based on what, Diego? Gut or instinct?
I'm using remote viewing.
Ah, okay.
I've been learning from y'all, and it really helps, and it really works.
Where is good old Planet X right about now?
It's on the far side of Jupiter.
All right.
It's coming. The second one is later part of this year, there should be some sort of what's called mock space battle in the sky between the reptilians and the Pleiadians, but it's just a holographic picture, nothing more.
All right, David, you're a scientist. What do you think of both of those?
Well, now, who's going to win the space battle? Is this going to be the reptilians or the other ones?
What happened is the Illuminati is going to send them some sort of drone airship, spaceship up there to chase and destroy everything. And it appears that the Illuminati wins. And what? The holographic picture just disappears.
All right. Well, that's Diego's predictions.
Okay. Well, that'll definitely be worth staying up for, you know.
Oh, sure.
I just hope it's not a cloudy night, that's all.
It sure will be. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, my name is Craig, and I'm from Santa Fe.
Hey, Craig.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this right here is that he's your guest said, I'm terrible about names, so forgive me.
David, just call him David.
Dave said that he would much rather rely upon a psychic than, like, for instance, a weather forecaster on a local TV station.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my question being is that knowing that psychics use the age-old parlor trick called cold reading, how can that be that accurate then?
Yeah, I think when I say I'd sort of, you know, prefer to hear the prediction of a psychic over a scientist for some things, what I'm saying is that, you know, if it's a prediction for something which I don't think the scientific models are going to be valid for, then, you know, I'd actually, I think the psychic, you know, one might be more interesting. Now, for something like, you know, if I was going to say what's the weather going to be like in 2 days' time, I'd stick with the weather forecaster, you know, because he's got a pretty good shot at it. My point isn't that scientific forecasters are worse than others. It's just that sometimes the other ones can be more entertaining.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George.
Yeah, go
David.
Ahead. Mm-hmm.
My name's Terry, and I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I have a theory / and prediction.
Right.
My theory is this, you know, like a corporation has the ability within America to cause enough turmoil or strife that could literally end in, you know, the end of the world, some sort of worldwide disaster, you know, nuclear war, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, this could be caused by a single corporation. For example, McDonald's. If McDonald's started to serve all-you-can-eat food, you know, the gluttony of the American public, 50% of us would be overweight. It would turn into all sorts of strife and civil war and turmoil. You know, this could lead to total disaster by the power of a corporation. Do you think that that's possible?
Well, in that particular case, I'm not sure. I think if we were all that grossly overweight, we wouldn't have the energy for turmoil.
Yeah, it'd be kind of self-limiting because we wouldn't have enough energy to go to McDonald's, you know.
Do you believe that time travel in the future is possible, David?
Personally, no. Actually, I don't think I'm a believer in time travel.
But don't you think predicting is sort of like time travel?
It is, you know. That's sort of the idea. I mean, that's what we want to do. We want to be able to dart forward in time. The title for the Canadian book Apollo's Arrow was actually Pythagoras was the owner of an arrow which was supposed to belong to Apollo, and it was supposed to give him the magical ability to sort of fly across space and also dart forward in time. And that's why I used it as the title, because I think that numerical prediction, our models are kind of, there are attempt, you know, there are Apollo's arrow, there are sort of magical thing to look into the future.
Let's go next to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Vernal, Utah. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
This is Edward. Colin, I wanted to ask you, and you just barely mentioned this, if you have read any of the early Los Alamos work about complexity theory, then you understand that one of the theories is that all systems, economic, political, religious, even biological, reach a point where they become so large that they essentially dissolve and reach a point of stasis and then begin reorganizing again. Yet at the same time, particular things will happen, like with the Stanley steamer was way ahead of combustion engines, and there was a hoof and mouth plague that made it so the people couldn't find water every 30 miles, and therefore the Stanley steamer was totally destroyed. Same thing with VHS and Beta, and they listed a dozen examples. And I read the book a long time ago, but I wondered how you could relate that or how you might use it in some of the work you've done.
Yeah, at actually, it's, you know, our last caller was from
Santa Fe, right? And there's this Santa Fe Institute, this really famous place where they do complexity research, and also Los Alamos, and they have these centers where they've made a lot of stride, you know, in recent decades, studying complex systems like ecosystems or like the economy, or also computer models of complex systems, and they do find that there are these properties where, as you say, you know, the system will become more and more kind of complex and refined and kind of rich and elaborate or whatever, and then all of a sudden it will kind of collapse under its own weight. And then, you know, started growing back. And, I mean, that's certainly what's happened throughout human history, right? You know, like the Roman Empire, it sort of grows and grows and extends until the extends in size until the whole thing kind of becomes unstable and then it collapses. And so you can certainly, you know, argue, for example, that our civilization has is also perhaps going through a similar process, that we've basically been so successful, you know, in the last several hundred years, that we've kind of taken over the entire world. And but now we're getting to a point where we're starting to run a bit short in resources. You know, you're noticing the price of oil going up, you notice the price of food going up, and you kind of think, well, actually, we are sort of approaching limits here, you know, and there is a chance that our civilization, too, could kind of, you know, undergo some sort of catastrophic change. Well, the problem is that's not really a prediction. That's more, and this is where I think that, you know, the complex systems approach to prediction is different, because you can't sort of say, okay, in the year 2050, we're going to run out of oil or something like that, because it doesn't work, you know. We're going to adapt. As oil becomes more expensive, we're going to adapt, we're going to find new sources of energy, and so on. So, but what you can do is you can sort of say, look, maybe we're overextending, maybe we need to be more careful, maybe we need to, you know, start looking for sustainable energy before we reach that point.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Appreciate your call. Let's move next to East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yep, go ahead, sir.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying your program like always. I have a prediction that in order to stay in power, the power that has established the corporation that is running the show now, there needs to be martial law declared. So there will be an event that happens here in the United States so that martial law is declared. And the administration that is running the show now will continue and go into the following year. That's what my prediction will be.
All right, there it is. And we will record that and keep it for posterity and see what happens. What fascinates me, David, is how the predictions are so wide-ranging.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you mean the predictions tonight?
Or constantly.
Yeah. Well, I think it just reflects the richness of life, right? You know, everything that, you know, human beings are concerned about, we want to predict. And that's sort of at its strongest when it comes, you know, down to, you know, things like this, you know, the future of the society, right? You know, everyone's fascinated by that, obviously.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's Richard from Chicago.
Hey, Richard.
Yeah, I wanted to know about some dreams. I had some dreams from when I was 11, and they lasted about a good 20 years. And they went on for a while, and one of them was about 9/11. I see 9/11. And in between these dreams, there were also some certain little, like, sporting events. And it seemed like that any time this sporting event would happen, these certain things would follow. And like the plane crashes, the one that crashed off the East Coast that crashed in the water, and just different little stuff like that. And I was wondering if these dreams, are they as accurate as, you know, because what I've seen is like what you just said about the martial law and everything. I also seen a dream about that, and that's coming. And I also seen something else that's going to happen in between that that's going to stop all of that. Something is going to come from the sky. I don't know if they were bombs dropping or if they were meteors or it was fire from the sky. And I just wanted to know if that's common.
Well, I'm not sure if it's coming, but what I'd like to know from you, David, is collectively, if so many people see the same thing or they predict the same thing, what does that tell you?
That's, for me, you sort of wonder if that's not picking up on some kind of an undercurrent, you know, in the society that you should pay attention to. I mean, I understand there are companies now that do things like search the internet, search websites, chat rooms, and stuff like that, you know, to sort of see what
we've had them on the air. Oh,
okay. So sort of, you know, like look what people are thinking about, what they're talking about, right? You know, and so stuff like that. Yeah, I can imagine that you could tap that kind of thing, you know, for some kind of predictive value. Now, interpreting it would be pretty hard, you know, because the problem again, you know, just like in ancient Greece with the Pythia, I mean, she would make these predictions, but they were pretty hard to interpret, and they often made more sense after the event.
Was she also, though, trying to control at that time? I bet she was.
Well, yeah, you have to sort of wonder, yeah, exactly, you know, because prediction is a very political business. I mean, predictors have their own...
agenda.
They have their own agenda. You know, for example, if someone starts pumping a stock, for example, on the stock market, you have to ask, well, why are they doing that? You know, do they own some of that stock or, you know, can they benefit from it going up?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's definitely always an issue, and I'm sure it was in ancient Greece as well.
I always used to tell myself when something happens, the first thing one should look at is who benefits from it.
That's a very good, that's a very, very useful way of sort of analyzing things. You know, you sort of say, okay, that person says that. Now let's kind of, you know, pick it apart and say what's behind it, right? Yeah.
See, I'm not a believer in coincidences, so I always believe things either are planned or they happen for a reason. And, you know, again, when you go back to the who benefits theory, you get a lot of answers when normally you wouldn't have had them.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
So what are you working on next? The other side of the coin, what's that about?
So that's a book about economics. And so it basically follows on a bit from the future of everything. But there is sort of a tremendous number of new economic theories which are been bubbling up over the past few years, and they're all influenced by new kinds of mathematics like complexity research, like chaos theory, fractals.
Well, like, I got to tell you, David, with what's going on with the economy right now, we probably need more theories. The future of everything, David Orrell. We'll be back in a moment with your predictions for the future on Coast to Coast AM.